And the first question, would you be willing to give advice on how to practice Buddha Anusati? Also, do you happen to know of any suttas which are particularly useful for working with this theme? It's actually the classic way of developing the Buddha Anusati is the as is in the inner chanting, and it's a refrain that comes up in the suttas over and over again of the qualities of the Buddha and the that iti piso bhagava raham samma sambuddho vicha charna sampanno sukato loko vidu. Good word of the Blessed One, the reputation is spread as follows. He, the Blessed One, is indeed the pure one, the perfectly enlightened one, impeccable in conduct and understanding, accomplished one, know of the worlds, trains perfectly those who wish to be trained, teacher of gods and humans, is awake and holy. And whenever Buddha Anusati is, this is how you, in the suttas, when it says this is what you do to do develop Buddha Anusati, and then that's all there is, and it's a bit, bare bones, and not clearly explained. So that I think one of the things is taking these different qualities and reflecting on them and thinking back to different suttas that illustrate these qualities, and that's where a study of the suttas is really helpful and useful, where one in one's reading and one's studying, then one starts to kind of gain a bit of a picture of the Buddha, and so that it's more of a in terms of suttas that are define how you should develop Buddha Anusati, then that's not very clear. But then, of course, the suttas are the whole compilation of the Buddha's teachings and give pictures of how the Buddha's interactions with the monastic community, with the lay community, with devas, and so that you start to get a picture of the Buddha, and in some he actually speaks of his background or his life, but not much. So that these are things that one starts to contemplate, and I think at different times different suttas will stick in one's mind and show different qualities. Just off the top of my head, and the Chulasi Anatta Sutta is one comes to my mind, of the lesser discourse on the kind of the lion's roar of the Buddha. It's in Majjhima Nikaya, and Buddha giving different responses to the reasons why his teaching is exceptional, very straight shooter on that theme. And another sutta that pops into my mind is the Diganaka Sutta, where the Buddha dealing with a kind of obstreperous Brahmin, and then giving a very clear response and explanation of the nature of the Dhamma, nature of the result of practice, and it always got me at the very beginning just the Buddha, how quick he was, how quick is his ability to not be flustered by you know, it's like this Brahmin sort of, you know, saying, basically giving a nihilistic view of the world and saying, you know, there's no point of having any views. And the Buddha says, oh, well, even that view, what about that view? And then the Brahmin kind of having to sort of bluff his way through it, and then the Buddha giving very good advice, particularly in the realm of feeling and its results, but also in as one reading the sutta, so that then there's this very human element of Sariputta. That day being the Upatak monk and looking after the needs of the Buddha, fanning him and listening to the Buddha dealing with this Brahmin, and then Sariputta getting enlightened. Mm-hmm. So it's just these when one recollecting the Buddha as an actual, real human being, as opposed to a sort of the cosmic Buddha principle, that I think it's a real important element to be reflecting and considering. Those recollections of the Buddha. I think one of the things that's important is that sense of how human or how real the Buddha was, and then these recollections of the Buddha being, you know, impeccable in his, say, knowledge and conduct. These are important qualities to be recollecting, being one who is training others, and really reflecting on these different ways. And that's where one, let's say, going through the suttas with that in mind, and that these are all illustrating the nature of the Buddha. No one thinks because sometimes it does in the later literature, the Buddha becomes kind of the cosmic principle with this aura of seven or nine different colored lights around him all the time, and it sort of distances him from the appreciation of that it's something that we can be using both as a recollection, but also as a model, and as a something to emulate, you know, these qualities or something to emulate. So that they say rather than, you know, these sort of cosmic, almost mythological elements. And the Buddha was very special, but he was also human. To be able to recollect, and to me, the, you know, some of the qualities of displaying that kind of humanness are also his kind of a wry sense of humor, where you know, he's telling about his ascetic practices and eating just a few jujube fruits a day, and the jujube fruits in those days weren't bigger than they were than they are now. And it's, you know, I wasn't eating much. Admonishing the monks to be wary of gain, honor, praise, and fame. Somebody who's sort of proud of those things or infatuated those things is sort of like a dung beetle who gets up on his ball of dung and says, "Look at me! Look at how big my ball of dung is." So that image is a wonderful sort of wry image. It's, the Buddha wasn't in human or beyond human. Understood so well human nature, but still he had these incredible qualities, incredible knowledge and understanding. So that using the one's study of the suttas and really take the time to read the suttas. Reading the primary sources of the Buddha's teachings, as opposed to reading some sort of popular kind of new agey reinterpretation of what the Buddha would have been like if he'd have been. If he was from Sedona or something. Next question is, can one use the subtle sensations of comfort and discomfort that accompany in and out breathing as a basis for insight? If so, how much thinking / nudging the mind is useful versus simple observation? Absolutely. That's, you know, really paying attention to those aspects of comfort and ease that come up associated with the breathing. And those aspects of kind of discomfort, and because, you know, that is the reality of the fact of having a human body, having the breath, having a human body, having a mind that changes, because those aspects of comfort and discomfort change or modulate or come in and out oftentimes without our agreement, and we're not totally in control. So that being able to, you know, a basis of insight, of course, is that non-self nature, if something were really in our control, then we if it were really ours and able to control, then we would be able to kind of adjust according to our preferences the degree of comfort and discomfort that we're experiencing, and that's obviously not the case. So that's a basis of insight into one that's impermanent, uncertain nature, anicca lakana. It's unsatisfactory and stressful in the sense of especially if one's counting on having it the way one wants all the time. There's inherent stress in that, inherent difficulty and dukkha. So the dukkha lakana is there. And then the non-self nature, so that one can always be turning one's experience, because whether the mind is focused and peaceful, or whether it's not focused and a bit scattered, one still has the opportunity of using it as a basis for insight, because these, you know, whether it's pleasurable or uncomfortable, that opportunity for insight is still there. And the opportunity for seeing it in its true nature is still there. It's not dependent on getting the mind into some ideal state that one is able to maintain. Until you live happily ever after, it's just this understanding of things in their true nature. So that the sense of how much thinking and nudging the mind is useful versus simple observation. Go back to the, I think it was the very first day of instruction that I emphasized the need for the recognition of what is it that leads to the increase in wholesome dhammas and the decrease in unwholesome dhammas, and what is it that increases unwholesome dhammas and decreases wholesome dhammas. And there's your you know, the degree of thinking or nudging or simple observation is not dependent on having a formula to hand in terms of, oh, I must be doing it right because I'm thinking in the right way, or I must be doing it right because I'm doing simple observations, and that's what I was told to do. But paying attention to what your mind is, the state of mind that you're experiencing, and what is it that is fruitful and beneficial, and what works and what doesn't work, what's skillful, what's unskillful, what allows the mind to establish itself in wholesome states of mind and to decrease the wholesome. So these are the aspects of investigation that are necessary, and so that sense of being able to really rely on whatever experience is arising in practice in order to develop those aspects of kind of a proficiency and confidence, and then, 'cause sometimes you go through periods of where, say, the breath might be there's some discomfort in the body, And does that mean that's the end of one's practice? Hardly. One has to be able to be willing to investigate and be present, and to not, neither to be shaken by the experience of dukkha, and not to take personally anything that arises, and seeing through the through phenomena with that lens of non-self. The last question today is could you please speak about Dhamma Vichaya and how to use it in meditation? So that Dhamma Vichaya is another, it's one of the factors of awakening, enlightenment, the Bojanga, the seven factors of awakening. Sati is the first one, Dhammavicaya, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, equanimity, so that those are part of the seven bojangas, and Dhammavicaya. So that investigation of Dhamma, contemplation of Dhamma, that contemplation of phenomena, contemplation of of the teachings, that can be, you've got a broad range of interpretation in terms of that word Dhammavicaya, whether it's the teachings or whether it's of phenomena, that works fine. So that aspects of Dhammavicaya, there's so many, categories of experience that one could be investigating from. So that, investigating from the aspect of, is this wholesome or unwholesome? Kusala dhamma, abhyakata dhamma. What's the nature of this experience? Is it wholesome, unwholesome? Is it unshakable? Is it firm? That's a way of investigating whether it's and breaking things down into a means of defining or experiencing. So. Is it a mental phenomenon or is it a physical phenomenon? Nama rupa, it's actually a meditation technique. That's one well-known meditation teacher in Thailand. It's really key. I think it's also an Abhidhamma teaching, where one using that as a basis for insight, of seeing this mental phenomena, physical phenomena, form and mind, just a way of framing. So that you're framing the investigation so that one is seeing things in ways that, rather than it being personal, or turning into a story, one is seeing it in terms of the its characteristics, seeing it in terms of the anicca, dukkha, anatta, its characteristics, of universal characteristics, seeing it in the light of the Four Noble Truths, seeing it in the light of the Khanda, seeing it in the light of the sixth sense basis, so that your experience in investigating it in a way that, that it, it becomes a framework for dispassion and relinquishment, or wisdom and understanding, seeing things in the way that that it's not stirring up greed, hatred, and delusion, not stirring up proliferation and objectification. It's these are this, this Dhamma Vicaya is a way of experiencing both the internal and external phenomena, so that we're able to establish a degree of clarity and not just stirring up the mind to more reactivity and cloudedness, so that, that this Dhamma Vicaya is not just thinking and proliferating and creating more stories about me and my practice, but it's framing things in a way that allows a clarity and mindfulness to really establish itself. So that this it's an important element. It's also one could relate it to say the word yoniso manasikara is appropriate attention and many different yoniso manasikara, appropriate attention, skillful attention, wise thought, many different ways that it's translated, but that looking at experience in a way that allows one to for the mind to not spin out, so that that Dhamma Vicaya, the investigation, contemplation, one uses thought and the thought processes, but you're using it in a way that allows for some clarity and understanding to arise, some dispassion and discernment, so that quality of Dhamma Vicaya is very, very important. And you notice that it's it precedes precedes effort in this progression of the those factors of awakening, so that one isn't, just because one is flailing around vigorously doesn't necessarily mean that one's effort is bearing fruit. One's effort needs to be directed with wise attention and that contemplation of Dhamma, so that one's effort really does bear fruit. Just being diligent and vigorous is not necessarily fruitful. It relies on the direction that's supplied by the investigation of Dhamma, and to be able to produce the results of kind of well-being and tranquility and settledness, equanimity. So that is not, those are not just end products that arise, you know, out of wishful thinking. It's because of the mindfulness and clear comprehension and application of Dhamma that those fruits are going to arise in the practice.